chocolate chip muffin.
Well, I can't deny a muffin.
Okay.
I'm kind of coffeed out.
Oh, okay.
Mark, I'm going to put the microphone there so it can hear both of us. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Mark Salvesberg.
Thank you.
Born and raised in Marin County.
All right. Well, I know you because I worked for you a long time ago, back in the late 90s.
One of my better employees.
Oh, really? That's hard to believe.
You were my cross-check.
I was your cross-check?
You were my cross-check.
What does that mean?
It means that I'd come up with an idea and flush it out a little bit, and you'd hear about it, and you'd poke holes in whatever I was doing at. So
I was a good hole poker. Yeah, a bullshit check.
Yeah, bullshit check. Yeah. That's good. Not that I did ever sell bullshit.
No, we, as someone who's, you know, later on gotten into the game of making and designing things or solving problems, having somebody around that calls your bluff on maybe not bullshit, but stuff that you're fooling yourself, you're deluding yourself almost.
You choose the path to drive on.
Right.
And you're going along there and you're shedding all the butts.
Mm-hmm.
You're shedding all the butts as you go along. And you come up with something that works, but for some reason or another, it's not gonna sell. It's not gonna be accepted. It's not gonna be accepted. So, say, I know it works, but it's not sellable.
Well, you know, I have a hard time believing that I was a good gauge on sellability, since I've proven in my life that I have no ability to be a marketing guy in any way.
You know, we're both similar that way for different reasons.
Right.
Yeah, but I look at something to see how it might sell. And like I said, you can find something that works, but it's not sellable for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And you run into it by coming up with reasons why it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, you need somebody around you to just give an impression of what you think.
Maggie.
Well, I'm lucky right now. I have maybe you'd call him a former mentee who is an extremely good mechanical and electrical engineer, that he loves calling my bullshit and points out ways that I'm not doing things right in ways that really challenge me and force me to
step up your game.
Yeah, that's it. It's like you gotta rise up and work harder and smarter than you thought you could. Almost just to beat them. Like, find the way so that they stop calling bullshit, you know, would be nice.
Yeah, I kind of look at it sometimes, it's like the kid who works at the parts department at the local motorcycle shop, and using that person as your gauge for whether something's going to work or not.
What the public would assume?
Yeah, so you're that kid is the master of everything tuning that comes into their shop. And you find out that that's very limited. Your exposure to the outside world, is limited by the fact that they're in one shop talking to a couple people, and those couple people think that he's God.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know that thing. It's like,
I do.
It's hard to be objective all the time. You have to work at it. And you have to get, it's like you say, you got to get people, somebody's got to call you bullshit.
Yeah, it's true. But something I've also been working on recently, and I'm hopefully going to write a blog post about it, is there's a path of let's say, knowledge in general, where the world is full of data. Within that data, there's information. From that information, you can get knowledge. From that knowledge, you can gain a perspective. And within that, you'll be able to be wise or have wisdom. All of this is a Venn diagram, and you're never, no matter what level you're at, not having to gain data and process information and get knowledge or add perspective. But some people never get out of the data. Some people never stop gathering information. You might get some knowledge, but not perspective. And when you say about being objective, you know, being objective, I think, is a good thing at times. But having a perspective is also good, too. The captain steers the ship. And if it's just floundering around, getting pushed around by the currents of the facts of the situation.
The current of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, where do you get to then, you know? And I think that perspective is very helpful. But once you've had a few different perspectives, and I'm sure you know, because you've grown through a lot of different ways of understanding things and having different perspectives, then you can gain this wisdom where you know that your perspective will change.
Here, you and I are at the same place.
Well, you're a little bit further along, I'm sure, than I am, because you've been playing this game longer.
Yeah, but you've had focused perception of bicycle stuff. And you've seen stuff go this way and that way.
Sure.
And things that you thought would work really well don't.
Right.
You know, but
and sometimes we're on the wrong side of that equation.
And that's where you get you said that word wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, as you, I hope you know, I work at a university right now.
Right.
And I have been for whatever 18 years.
Yeah.
And I'm around.
And I thought it was a perfect job for you.
Well, it's like any environment. It's a challenging environment.
You have different levels and different people's perception.
Well, you know, I mean, I won't dwell on the negative side of it, but the thing is, it's an institution, you know. But we have students and we have professors. 1 in 10 of our professors are pretty good. Maybe 1 in 20 of our students are pretty good. You know, so you're filtering through that constantly in terms of you don't listen to somebody just because they're in front of you. You have to kind of test them and feel them out and learn what they know about. It's sort of like you. I use you as an example, and I hope you don't take too much offense at this.
No.
I've learned through my life that people have certain unbelievable expertise in certain subjects and little knowledge or understanding in others, even if they're closely associated. And I use you as an example. I say, if you wanted to talk about fuel mixing and ignition, Mark Salvisburg is hands down the guy to talk to, and you should hang on every word. But once Mark starts talking about suspension, you should just stop listening. And that's just how we are. I'm going to have the same problems. I have areas that I really kind of stink at. I'm a terrible welder. I mean, just from a practical standpoint. But I get by enough to weld a bike together, you know? But that's not what I'm focused on.
Yeah.
You know? I'm sure you've experienced that yourself, where there's people you call for certain things and not other things.
You know, the sad thing is, this is just an amusing side note. A guy, I used to call up this guy about tuning.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'd run into something.
What kind of tuning?
Carburetor tuning.
Uh-huh.
And I used to call him up probably once a year and ask him a question about carburetors and the way they worked. And the life was all fine. Because I always had this guy to call up.
Mm.
And he'd always have some wisdom. Wisdom. And sometimes the wisdom was, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I called him up about carburetor stuff, I asked him about how something worked. And he said, I don't know. He goes, don't you know? I said, no, I don't know. And he goes, well, if you don't know, who the hell does know?
Uh-huh.
I went, oh, that's a sad state of affairs to where somebody thinks that I know everything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I even noted that in a recent blog post where I was talking about just simple descriptions of bicycle stuff. And whether we should use direct front center or horizontal front center describing a bike geometry. And there's good arguments for both sides. My problem right now is I don't know who on earth I would call to ask the question to help me figure it out. Because, I mean, I'm not being cocky, just I've been dealing with...
No, you've done it for such a long time. I mean, even a monkey like me could figure it out if I did it for 30 years.
Right. It's tough. And when you don't know who to talk to about something and you're the only one,
yeah.
What kind of, it's a very terrifying feeling. No one can save you. No one can bail you out.
And you have a trail of people following you. Thinking that you know everything.
And you don't know much. You just might know a little more than them.
The more you know, definitely, without a doubt, the more you know, the less you know.
Yeah.
You didn't even know there was a question to ask.
Right.
And you're the only one who actually, you're one of the few people who thinks to that level. And has that much experience.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, in your game of squeezing more power out of a motorcycle or an engine, getting the carburation or the ignition to be just what it needs to be, who did you see as being a rival or nemesis or someone who were you doing battle with a dragon, right? Who would that have been?
God. I started road racing when I was 21 years old, which is late for most people. And I, amazingly enough, don't get along with everybody.
Right.
You can understand.
Yes, I do.
And I did everything myself because I didn't have any money.
Right.
So having no money and doing everything yourself, you learn things and you go along in that path. But as you learn things and they do better and better, you alienate the people who you might be following.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that I looked up to were all local people who didn't race,
mm-hmm.
but did tuning. And that would be like Jim Dewar at Megacycle Cams, Kenny Augustine, Cylinder Head Work, Para Osterson. For just sheer beauty of everything that Para did was a jewel.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and I figured out I'll never do as good as him, so I'm not even gonna try.
Right.
And I was never as good as each one of those people were in their field. Dennis Murray, Murray Exhaust Systems. They're all like a generation ahead of me. They're like 5 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's people that I didn't compete with. The hardest thing when I started factory, the hardest thing that to deal with was I was racing at the same time. And I had trouble getting customers sometimes because I would be going as fast as I could on the racetrack, and I'd win a race, and that didn't endear me to anybody else because mm-hmm. I was racing at the same time, and they would be racing against me and my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, it's not just me. It's my stuff.
Right. And there are tribes and cliques and loyalties to sponsors and things like that that get mixed in too.
Yeah, exactly. So, Sandy Cosman, the guy who could take nothing and make gold out of it, and then charge twice as much as anybody else would,
mm-hmm.
and still manage to do well.
Did you know that, I'm trying to remember what year it was, sometime in the mid-2000s, I actually went up to Sandy's shop up in Windsor and hung out with him for a day.
He's phenomenal.
That guy is... I was very lucky because I got to see not Sandy Cosman at a trade show or a racetrack. I got to see him in his shop and talk with him about what he did, much like I spent plenty of days with you. And I got to see him in action being him. And it's very interesting when you see people. I think he was extremely, was it autistic or... He had some sort of
Asperger's
or imbalance type thing that made him, he could focus in like a laser on something and not see anything else or whatever it was. And it was like, so I could see these things that made his life difficult, but also made his life incredible. And it was pretty cool, you know? And
it's wisdom.
Yeah.
You got to experience something externally that you would build up in yourself internally. So you get a glimpse of wisdom.
Right, right. And how it's really done.
Yeah, or a way to do it.
Uh-huh.
I always think if we do something cheaper, quicker, and better, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do a machining process, you do it quicker and better
mm-hmm.
and cheaper. It's like, why wouldn't you do it? So that's what I always try to do. The whole carburetor kit thing started up as rather than talk to somebody on the phone for 2 hours, I said...
I'll just mail you the stuff.
I'll mail you the stuff, and it'll have good instructions
uh-huh.
and the procedures and how to fine tune. And
had anybody had a kit when you started doing that?
Yeah, Dynajet had a kit.
How long have they been doing it?
A lot longer than me.
Uh huh.
But it's like I could make better instructions, and I could be better on the telephone.
Mm-hmm. Just because they were actually talking to you rather than some general employee at Dynajet type of thing?
Yeah.
But what motivated you to think, oh, I'm going to sell a jet kit, and even though Dynajet has one, why did you think that you could make that happen, or was it?
I think I'm stubborn as hell. I think I could do a better job.
Uh huh.
I could write better instructions. I could do tuning better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm more patient with people.
Mm-hmm. I can attest to that.
So you've run into people who are less patient than me?
Oh, yeah. But also people that are more. But the thing is that, you know, people that are very good at craft or at developing knowledge or building knowledge, sometimes, or I think in general, aren't the same people that are very good with people. As you know, I'm sure you've known plenty of people in your life that they just want to work in the shop alone with one light bulb on, and they might do extremely good work, but you're never going to have a discussion with them about it because they're probably drunk, you know, or something.
I find that people who are good at doing real fine tuning tend to have tendencies, and one of them is the tendency to have problems, emotional problems,
mm-hmm.
because they're sensitive. And the more sensitive you are, the better job you can do, but the more vulnerable it makes you in the real world.
That's interesting. I'm kind of a crybaby on the inside. Maybe that's what sets me off on these errands that I run, you know?
Yeah, I get my butt hurt.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and you say, years later, you say to the guy, you really hurt my feelings when you did this 10 years ago. And he goes, what?
Yeah.
I was just
screwing around.
Just screwing around and poking at you a little bit. So I said, well, I took it as gospel truth for 10 years.
Right. Yeah, that's a tricky thing, you know. I mentioned, and I've kind of wrote the intro to my blog post that'll be for this interview, that about what brought me to Factory and meeting you. And then a few things about being there. And there's another thing that I mention about you when I talk to other people. There was one day we were working on some motorcycle, and I don't know what it was, GSXR or some whatever high-end sport bike. And I think we had changed the jets in it like 30 times. And at the time, Joe Cioni worked with you, but I think he was out of the shop. And it was just me and you, and I had changed those jets so many times. I was bloody sick of it. And
I'm like, let's keep doing it.
Oh, yeah, of course you were. You were going to go all the way. And I was pissed, and I was so angry.
You got pissed at me?
Yeah. No, I was furious because I was just sick of it. And I think at one point you watched me scowling away in the shop through the dyno window. And you slid the window open and you said, Pete, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm changing the fucking jets on this motorcycle again. Fuck. I was pissed. And it was years later. And I don't know how you meant it. But years later, I realized that at the time, all I was doing was showing up for a job and taking a paycheck. And what you were doing was you were solving a great puzzle. And you were playing the chess master. And you were playing your best game, in a way. And I totally didn't get it at the time. I mean, this is the folly of a young man. But it was years later where I realized that. And it was like something you said to me that stuck out and kind of had me see something, but it was a delayed reaction. That's the way I took it.
That's probably the way I meant it.
Yeah.
It's just like, what are you doing here?
Right.
You're just changing jets.
Right. We all have our times in our life where we just miss it. And I was missing it.
Yeah, but you got it.
Eventually. It took a while.
That's the next best thing to getting it immediately.
It is better than never getting it at all, that's for sure. Let me get a list. I had a group of questions I'm going to pull out of my bag. Because I figured... That's your phone. Do you need me to pass it to you? Oh, there you go.
It heard it turned off.
All right.
It's hung up anyway.
All right. Did you ever go to college or trade school?
We went to College of Marin. And I took stuff that I wanted to take. I got business law, drafting, which didn't stick. Psychology.
Were you doing motorcycles at the time?
Yeah.
Were you? You were just riding or racing?
Racing.
Did you ever just ride, or did you just go straight to the track?
No, I rode and. There's many dents in the asphalt that Marin County.
Yeah.
Not caused by my foot pegs.
Oh, okay.
Hitting the ground.
Nice. Okay, cool.
Yeah, let's see. I took welding.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured welding wasn't for me when they started to do overhead arc welding.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, that's not fun.
Yeah, you don't like a shower of sparks.
No, shower of sparks.
Okay, but you weren't trying to get a degree. You were just following what was interesting to you.
I wanted to take classes that I wanted to know the answers to.
Uh-huh.
So, like I said, no degree. It was just using it for education.
Uh-huh. Real education.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Were you a good student?
I was a shitty student.
Uh-huh. Did you fail most of your classes, or did you get C's, or just B's or something?
I got A's. I got A's and stuff that I didn't really care about, because I knew the answers already, or right. I thought I knew the answers already. And then I had some things that were just difficult. Some math classes were... Math is not my friend.
Mm-hmm.
I go more by feeling. And, yeah, I go more by feeling.
What drew you to motorized things? Was it the motor thing, or was it the motorcycle?
It was the motor thing. It was like Briggs & Stratton engine, and with a spark plug exposed on the top. When you kill the motor, you flip over the little bale and it grounds it out.
Mm-hmm.
That
was kind of the inception?
Yeah, I like the smell.
Hmm. Well, it's good because you ended up in a dyno room for so many years.
Yeah. So
it was a smell and a tactile thing more than a
definitely
precision
tactile.
Mechanical thing?
No, it wasn't precision mechanical.
Uh-huh.
It was definitely tactile, sentient.
Did you like the vibrations as well?
I liked the feeling of control.
Like you could unleash the power?
I could work the power with the throttle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part that really got me hooked was I took a dry leaf and I... grounded it out on the spark plug, and it didn't do anything. And I said, "Oh, that's why dry leaves don't conduct electricity." And then, which brought me to grabbing a green leaf and putting it on the spark plug while the engine was running, and it shocked the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, note to self: green leaf conduct electricity."
Okay.
But it got to be a big puzzle.
Uh-huh.
And I enjoyed the puzzle. I enjoyed the puzzle part of it.
It feels like that to me, a puzzle, when I'm working on problems.
Yeah. And you could be... have a... the IQ average and do Einstein work if you give him 10,000 years to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think, you know, I was watching some stuff about, who was the Richard Feynman. I was watching some Richard Feynman, and I think he's kind of the patron saint to folks like me. He's a little bit streetwise and feels he's of average intellect. He just focused on problems and put the time and hard work into them rather than imagining that he had to be some kind of genius to figure things out.
I think that's where you and I are the same. We're the same as both the same as Richard Feynman.
Well, that's why I say he's a very wise person, and people would call him the smartest man in the world at times, and he was like, "No way,
I'm just stubborn."
Yes, I'm just playing this puzzle all the way to the end, right? How's this? What was your first motorcycle?
A Hodaka 100.
Oh yeah, what happened to that?
I modified it to the infinite craziness,
and it broke.
And it broke like hell.
Yes, I figured the first one. And I was going to ask you what was so interesting about motorcycles, but really it's the motor.
It's the feeling.
Of riding them, or the motor and the power control?
Same.
Uh-huh.
Same thing. When you're riding, you're working, racing anyway, you're working up to the edge of traction and trying to maintain the edge of traction all the time, and
how to get more out of the motor.
And how to get more out of the motor. But you're always working the edge of mechanical limitations. So you're once again like working up to an edge.
It's nice to be at the edge, because when things break, you know what to fix. But if you're not at the edge, you don't know what to fix.
Yeah.
When systems fall apart, they are telling you that there's a repair that's needed.
Yeah,
if they're just getting along, how do you know what's going on?
Yeah, where's the weak spot?
Right.
Where's your limitation? And then I figured... when I got to be career-wise, I worked in a motorcycle shop and basically ported cylinders at night.
For other racers?
Yeah, for other racers. RD350s.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of them.
I had an RD400 when I first started working for you. I think I sold it. Or did I sell it before that? I blew it up on the Bay Bridge. No, not Bay Bridge, Richmond Bridge. I had restored this stupid thing, and I think something happened with the oil line, and I fried a piston or something.
You found your limitation.
Well, certainly with that project, but I wasn't too into two strokes. I was a different generation and all that stuff. Apart from making money, what were you trying to do with Factory?
pay the bills.
No, I mean apart from the money part of it.
Doing something, I mean, not being egotistical, but doing something better than anybody else could possibly do it. And how do you know? How do you know that you've attained that? That's a good question. How do you know when you've attained the maximum that you can possibly get? And it's when you take your assembly, whatever you're working on, and know that if you change it at all, if you change one little main jet, one little pilot air jet, one little main air jet, you're going to lose horsepower. So you're done when you can't change anything. And if you do change something, you lose horsepower.
You just ran out of options that added more and didn't distract.
There's nothing more to change. there's nothing more to change.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can say the only way anybody can do anything as good as this is to copy what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only one bike I can think of that it was really hard to do. It was a 95 ZX6R. That it finally dawned on me that it was true that the only way anybody could do anything as good as this was to copy it exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And
felt like you'd finally kind of played the game as well as you could have played it, type of thing?
Yeah, it was as good as it was going to get, and it's not going to get any better.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only reached that a couple times.
Right. It's difficult. Perfection's a difficult thing.
How do you know it's perfect?
Well, that's the thing. When I told you I was with Sandy Cosman, and I was talking about a project I was trying to do. Because I was, you know, we've all had our ups and downs at life.
Sure.
And I was setting up to build motorcycle chassis. I wanted to make motorcycles. And my divorce and my marriage falling apart and all that stuff kind of derailed me enough that I ended up working on bicycles more. But then I figured out something about bicycles that I felt everyone was missing and that I was missing. And it's kind of spiraled into whatever it has done so far. But when I was visiting with Sandy Cosman, I was describing all this stuff. And he accused me of being a perfectionist, which may have been a true statement at the time, and that if your only goal is perfection, you can't get anything done.
And the only way to get perfection is to make sure the math works. And I mean, you calculate it out what you want to calculate out, and you make up numbers to get to the result that you're looking for. But that, you get out in the real world and find out that the numbers, the reason why it doesn't work as well as you thought it was going to work is the numbers are wrong.
Right. Yeah, and there's too many variables.
Yeah.
There's just so many. But he had accused me of perfectionism, and I was pissed, but he was probably right. That was probably what was stopping me from actually getting something done.
We had some discussions about frame geometry. And I tried to make it. You had your way of doing it, which was different from the way everybody else was doing it. And I had an idea that you weren't right, and the rest of everybody else was wrong, too. And I was the only one who was right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how anybody can disagree with me.
Right.
What the hell?
Oh, yeah, I know that feeling. It's tough. It's tough because, I mean, that's maybe the stubbornness that you're talking about. And the
tenacious.
Yeah, and not letting go.
You put your heart into it.
You got to.
Yeah.
You got to, because the world's full of people that aren't doing that, and it's so difficult to do anything in real life that if you aren't really, really trying, you won't even come close to doing a thing, let alone doing it well, let alone being the best. And the people that aren't willing to truly try hard, they never do anything.
They get a job.
Right.
They get a job working for the county.
They punch a clock. Granted, I'm a state employee officially. But I think I'm on the right side of that equation. What did you hope that factory would have become?
The almighty master of time, space, and being.
Okay. Megacorp.
Megacorp.
I mean, it was what it was, but what had you dreamt it could become?
Well, now I got two employees.
Uh-huh.
I had 11 employees, I think, when you were working there.
Yeah, it was a real operation.
Yeah, it was like, I wanted to make a real business out of it, and it was a real business. And now it's not, it's the market's smaller. Market's a lot smaller.
Well, it's just such a different world now.
So, what'd you call it? Megacorp?
Megacorp.
I want it to be Megacorp.
What was your largest professional failure in your mind? Not personal, but professional, like a business decision or a relationship with a vendor or client or employee.
We had a motorcycle manufacturer who wanted us to do carburetor work for them, and they weren't doing it right, so I told them I didn't want to do it.
And why is that a failure in your mind?
It had to do with money.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You would have made good money on that deal?
Yeah, I would have had. Would have done fine.
Uh-huh. What's your greatest professional success in your mind?
I think the fact that I feel I did a good job in just about everything. I say just about. Just about everything I did that worked, that we sold, that was a good product. And
it wasn't bullshit.
Yeah, it wasn't bullshit.
What did you love about your career with motorcycles?
The fact that I could use my own products and work well. Turn it off for a second.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're back.
Okay, so one of the things that I read about that made all the sense in the world was that, I don't know who wrote it, but it was a description of times in your life. When you're a kid, I'm doing this by sort of winging this as I go along here. But when you're a kid, you learn basic things when you play. Nobody expects you to do anything, but you learn sort of innate things, how things work. And then you do a period of time, an area of time that you work and build things, and then towards the end of your time, you you become more of a teacher. The older you get, the more teachy you get.
I'm pretty bad about that right now. I mean, bad in the sense that I feel like I'm doing mostly teaching. I don't know if I'm old enough yet.
Yeah.
But I am at a school, and I do have my problems with what the other teachers are saying.
And you're not going to change anybody's mind on Facebook.
Not especially. I have my own blog, but this is actually an interesting semester. I feel like I'm touching more students than I usually do.
When they see you as competition, they don't learn.
Mm-hmm.
When they see you as a teacher, and they can learn from you, that's kind of satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I value like what you said about changing jets and what are you doing here.
Mm-hmm.
That means a lot. It means that what I did in my mid-years actually had an effect on somebody, a positive effect on somebody.
It definitely did.
Yeah. And
well, there's more I learned from you as well.
Yeah.
I think there was one day, it was going to be like a we're riding bikes all the time then too, bicycles. And there was one time on a Saturday or something like that, I had to go in the shop for, I don't know, something, whatever it was. And you were in there measuring some cams in the middle of a Saturday, all alone with this new cam measuring tool or something like that.
Oh, God, I remember that.
Yeah, and I was just like, son of a bitch. After that hard week that we just worked in this damn place, Mark's in here fucking measuring cams, trying to figure this part out and everything. And, you know, this is the problem of being a young man, but part of the thing about having to be good role models for young men is that they see that, right? And it's like, I saw that. So then years later, when I'm thinking, and I'm starting to get it, I'm thinking about Mark in there on Saturday measuring cams.
Sorry. I'm glad I did something. I'm glad I did something right.
That's a thing. And, you know, I got to see you do all that. And I might not have agreed with you. I might not have thought you were right all the time. But you were definitely, you were solving that problem. And now that I'm solving the problem, you know, I have to have someone see that, right? So I post it all on the internet. And I try to talk to students and talk to other people and get them to see the work and the information and the challenge of it. And I post my failures, too. You know, one of the hard things about you being in business is you can't post failures.
You can't.
And that's one thing I've really appreciated about what I can do is I can have a bike break, and I can spend 20 pages talking about what I did wrong and what was stupid about my thinking or how I was blind. And it's not going to affect my sales. It's not going to of course, on the internet or in life, everyone likes to point at the failure and say, you're obviously stupid, but the thing is, it's like, compared to them actually doing nothing, it doesn't matter what they think.
It's easy to poke a finger at.
Right.
If you don't do it.
Right. So I do try to... I try to move that stuff forward so other people can see it. And I'm saying, I saw that in you. And because I was around you, I could learn how to play the puzzle master. What was your favorite motorcycle?
Oh, yeah, RD350.
Really? I thought you liked the FC750.
I like it. I love it. But I don't... But when I get onto an RD, it feels perfect to me. Like the foot pegs are in exactly the right place. And
it's home.
It's like the first airplane you flew, the first mm-hmm. first car you had. And it's just home. It's home. It's relaxing.
You've gone to a lot of motorcycle races. Big ones. And you've been not exactly a spectator. When you walk within the pits, you're Mark Salvesberg. What are you thinking when you're at those races? When you go to them? Now, there's times you're going to be a salesperson, but like other than that.
I appreciate the team manager. I appreciate anybody's team manager for keeping it all together on the track and realizing that I'm 68. I don't want to do it anymore. I don't want to be responsible for picking the right tire compound.
Uh-huh. And the fact that they're doing that all the time.
Doing that all the time. I've lived my life in hotels and rental cars.
Uh-huh.
So I appreciate how much hard work that those team managers do. That's what I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want their job.
Mm-hmm. We're going to drift off of motorcycles a bit now. What's your favorite kind of problem?
Problem that nobody else wants to do because it's too hard.
Uh-huh.
It's competition.
So it's a competitive... It's your race.
It's my race. And uh-huh. I prefer that there's nobody else in it. But that doesn't happen very often.
Right, that's true. But just, it's a hard problem. It's a, you know, one of the things I talk to people about, when I talk about what I'm doing, me, Peter Verdone, I work on tilt-steer vehicles, bicycles, motorcycles, and skateboards. The rider is an integral part of the chassis and the handling and how it works.
A lot of it.
And I describe it as an unsolvable problem. And no matter what I do, if I somehow figured out the magic formula, let's say for a bicycle, and got it to do exactly what I want, the very next thing that would happen would be me or the rider would hack that. And they'd start using it differently than it had ever been used before. And because of that, they'd learn a new way or influence it a new way that now it needed to be changed again. And so that no matter what I do, I can never solve the problem. It might get better in certain parameters. It might improve overall. But there'll always be a change that's needed. And I'm feeling it's difficult because I'll just never solve the problem.
Yeah, what comes to mind is like proclaiming that there's magic numbers,
right,
for geometry and spring rates and on a motorcycle.
It's insane.
To make something work perfectly, at Sears Point, you have to have a high rising rate spring and the carousel is like where you want no damping at all in your suspension because you're leaned way over. Yeah, because you're leaned way over and you don't want any damping in your suspension when you're leaned way over. But under hard braking, you need a high rising rate because there's super hard braking
mm-hmm.
on that track.
And yeah, it's like 150 miles an hour to 20.
Yeah, that's the marketing numbers, yeah.
I can't remember, I'm trying to think.
It's pretty fast.
Yeah.
But it's very abrupt. And if you take something and you make it work superlatively at Sears Point, and then you go to Laguna Seca the next day, you'll just about scare the hell out of yourself because it won't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
So for each usage, is what you're saying, for each usage, there's a set of numbers that work optimally.
Yeah, but the rider could change their mood the next day. The
rider could change his mood, change the track.
Yeah.
There is no
different competitors.
Different techniques.
Yeah. So if that's a tricky problem.
There is no answer.
What's your least favorite kind of problem?
Least favorite problem. The ones where people have an ingrained mental solution to the problem and it's not quite as good as it could be. And I'll think of a way to make it better. It's like what you're doing, Pete, about your numbers, too. I hate the problems like what you described, to where the rider could change, the track could change, styles could change. I hate those problems because you can get them to work many different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not one discrete path.
Yeah.
Over all the years, what employees have you had that made you work harder and better?
Most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say most of them, because everybody does something better. Or at least has the option of doing it better than I do. So having employees that know how to do things that I don't know how to do, those are the best.
Mm-hmm. What got you interested in airplanes?
I was about 10 years old. I went up to Shelville Airport because a guy named Larry Hamilton had a P-51 Mustang.
Wow.
And he paid $750 for it.
It's a good investment.
Yeah.
As long as it doesn't fall out of the sky.
But I remember standing underneath the prop, and I said, I'm going to learn how to fly an airplane. And then we finally moved the shop, and I didn't. But then we finally moved the shop close to Santa Fe Airport.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, I don't have an excuse now. So then I started taking lessons in 2003.
It was 2003.
Yeah.
But you had Even when I was at factory in the late 90s, you were doing flight simulator like crazy.
Yeah, I spent like a lifetime doing that, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. And you got over that, you wanted to do the real thing.
Yeah.
Was that, what were you trying to do when you played the flight simulator?
It was the next best thing to, the next best thing to flying a real airplane was to do flight simulator.
Mm-hmm.
I probably still have foot pedals and stuff upstairs.
How many planes have you owned?
I rented.
Mm-hmm. Which one was your favorite that you've flown?
Favorite airplane that I flew, I got 3 hours of flight training and a B-25 bomber.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Did you controlled it?
Yeah.
What did you notice when you were in that position?
The sheer awesomeness of being... It'd be like the first time you drove a semi-tractor trailer, right? It's like, you're in it. You're this small little insignificant bit of protoplasm surrounded by metal, of tons and tons and tons of metal. And...
And could also hold bombs in it if it wanted to.
Bombs. And the yoke... The yoke was attached to the elevators and ailerons. And when I did a steep turn, I said to my trainer, I said, geez, that sure is hard. He goes, see those wings out there? The 66 foot wingspan. And you got a metal wire cable attached to this yoke.
They weren't hydraulic?
No, they're not hydraulic.
Oh, my God. Okay.
You're the one making this thing change.
Wow.
I said, God, I have more respect now.
Damn.
Yeah.
What do you think is similar between airplanes and motorcycles?
Oh, without a doubt, airplane flying is like motorcycles in 3D.
You can just go in any direction.
You have that option of going up and down.
Uh-huh.
Motorcycle, you sit there and you're flat on the ground.
And you can take any bank turn you want.
Any bank turn you want. The airplane is... Just like you can go up and down. You can pitch things sideways. I found out coming in and crossed up and there's a side wind. It's like pitching something sideways going into a corner on a motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
And my trainer said, he goes, you do that pretty well. I said, yeah, it's just like pitching it sideways in a corner.
I'm sure you've done a few projects having to do with planes. What's a cool one that comes to mind?
They gave me three plates of form-fitted aluminum for Lockheed Electra Model 10 Electra. It's a sister ship to Amelia Earhart's airplane. It's
the Vega?
No, the...
The crash one?
The Lockheed Electra.
Mm-hmm.
That one.
My mind's all in Vega right now. I don't know if you saw my most recent blog post.
No, I didn't have...
I just did a new bicycle for my wife. And I named my bicycles after infamous spacecraft, Fact or Fiction. Her last bicycle was the Glamorous Glennis.
Okay.
This one is the Vega. and Glamorous Glennis, obviously, is Chuck Norris's plane's name.
Right.
In fact, it was all of his plane's name, a derivative of Glennis or Glamorous Glennis. All his fighter planes and stuff like that. Kind of interesting. Anyway, the new bike is the Vega after Amelia Earhart's plane that she did her solo transcontinental and transatlantic flights. Thought you'd like that, since you were talking about the Electra. You should check that out. It's a cool post.
I will.
It's a cool bike. Okay, so what were you doing with the plates for the Electra?
Oh, they gave me three plates, and they were like form-fitted over some exhaust manifold thing, and they were supposed to be layered on top of each other, but they were different depending on which order you put them together because of the radius of radii. And they sat there and they said, you put these on. And I said, you got pictures of how these go on? Because these are obviously three virtually identical parts. They go in a certain order because the screws won't quite line up. And they sat there and watched me for an hour, putting them on in different orders. And finally I got the...
The order.
Finally I got the order. And
that's probably scary work to do because you don't want to strip out threads. Sometimes with sheet metal plates, you kind of have to nudge it a little to get it to fit correctly, but that could lead you to doing the wrong thing also.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was the last... I got the last screw out of, like, there was like 15, 16 screws on each one of the plates. And the last screw almost didn't go in. But I'd gotten to the almost the last screw before.
Oh, really?
So anyway, I finally got it all done. That was a Lockheed Electra Model 10. Yeah, that was the funnest thing I got to work on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was significant about the particular plane that you were working on?
That's the one that she got lost in.
That model.
Yeah.
Right.
The Vega, I guess she made it.
She did her transcontinental and transatlantic flights.
Yeah, the one she made.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the one she got lost in.
Right, yeah. You only get to not make it once.
Yeah. You stop learning then.
Yeah. The lesson's over. What's some advice you wish you got long ago?
Wish somebody would have given me some lessons on how to get along with other people.
Mm-hmm.
I have a tendency to be a little too adamant. Yeah, so I saw people who weren't as dedicated get along fine because they got along fine with other people. And that sort of brought them up. And I was more adamant about doing it the right way. And that made it a little hard to get along with some people.
Boy, do I hear that one in my world. You know, I'm busy fighting everyone.
It's a good fight.
What's some advice you should have given other people?
What's some advice? Do the best you can. Oh, it's kind of cliche. Do the best you can in everything you do. Like if you get to work on a crappy part of a motorcycle, when you're done with it, make sure that the area that you worked on is a jewel.
Uh-huh.
Even if it's a crappy motorcycle or a crappy car or a crappy project.
Whatever it is.
Make whatever you did perfect. as perfect as it can be. Oh, you're asking about how do you know when you're done? A machinist friend of mine said we have a saying about that because we can always do it better. It's not cost effective, but we can always do it better. And he said, we have a saying. I said, what's that? He said, it's perfect enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay.
Right.
Makes sense.
Who are you jealous or envious of?
Oh, when I was younger, I used to be more jealous, but I'm older now and I don't feel so jealous of people.
Especially the dead ones?
Especially the dead ones. Yeah. No, I feel jealous about people who didn't work for themselves and work for the county.
Working for yourself is very, very hard.
It is hard.
And I don't play that game. Because...
You're smarter than me.
Well, both my parents work for themselves in large part. And I have a lot of friends and people that I've known that have run companies like you.
Yeah.
And while there's great things about that, there's some lousy things about that. And we all just have to play our cards. Maybe I'm just a chicken shit, you know, at the end of the day.
Well, you hang your linen out.
Yeah. The world's different now. Very different from even just 20 years ago. If you were leaving high school today, what would you try to do with your life? In this world right now, what attracts you, or what would you want to go pursue with all that energy you've had to expend in your life?
Well, not changing my personality.
Right.
I think I'd go find something that interests you that's popular. It doesn't have an end date on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, do your best.
Like sell toothpaste.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, you know what I used to say? It's like, if I die and come back, I'm not going to start my own business doing parts for vehicles that hardly anybody rides.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to sell toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody uses toilet paper.
Yeah.
That's my advice. Sell toilet paper.
How would you want to be remembered?
As a guy who tried.
It's pretty good.
It's about as good as it's going to get.
I've said that myself. That at the end of the day, it's almost the only thing you could be remembered for. Right? Is having fucking tried.
I have five patents. And I said, there's my contribution to society. And that'll at least hang around until this civilization dies.
Right, your name's in print in the right book.
It's in print in the right books.
Right. You know, I had an opportunity to do some patents for my skateboard trucks. I had like, I don't know, four patentable components to them. This is back in 2000-ish when I designed those. And I didn't do it, mainly because there's no market. I'm not going to get any money back on the cost that it would do to patent them. Nobody wants to buy the patent.
I'll just copy it.
It would just be a thing. And it would be, I would have my name in the book. But the thing is, I didn't do it. And there's sometimes, and I have friends that have patents as well. And then sometimes I'm really kind of bummed that I never did the patent thing. But at the same time, I'm going to be forgotten anyway, in my mind. You know, and it's like the stupid skateboard truck thing nobody cares about. And while I could have gotten them, I didn't. And it's one of those fussy things because you can sit here and say you have 5 patents and I can't. I'm jealous. How's that? I discovered a superpower a while back. And that's that if you're jealous or envious of somebody, you tell it to them in person that you are jealous and envious of them. And it's the most freeing and liberating thing you can do. Because if you don't do that, it festers in you, or me, it does. And if I tell the person, if I say, oh, I'm jealous of you, or envious of you, it kind of puts the ball in my court, in a way. I'm jealous of you because you spent the money and did the work to make that happen, and I didn't. And it's like, well, whose fault is that, right?
Yeah.
And and it comes back on me. It's like, well, if I want that, I have to do the work, or I have to spend the money. And but if I just sit there and get all jealous, and that stays all locked up, well, then they become this monster. They're the bad guy. And I just kind of like found that if I just say it to them, I'm free. Or it puts the onus on me. I better step up.
I was something like that too. It's when you get to something that the other person does, and you don't do it. My saying is, well, obviously I didn't care enough.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would have done something, and I didn't do anything, so I didn't care enough.
Right.
So same thing.
We're responsible for our own failures most of the time, right?
By hook or crook, we can make ourselves fail.
Yeah. What are thoughts that are on your mind?
Cure for Parkinson's.
A cure for Parkinson's.
Yeah.
When did it start hitting you?
In hindsight, it's like I kind of knew. In hindsight, probably about six or 7 years ago, I tripped in a bar. I didn't lift my foot up high enough when I went to turn around. And I fell down on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I'll be shit fired. You know, I've never tripped before.
Mm-hmm.
Then I noticed that going through door frames, walking fast, I'd sort of bump on them.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, when I used to miss them all the time. And then a few other things happened, and they said, why don't you go to the doctor? I said, what for?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, anyway.
Well, I have my own concerns. My memory and my brain speed have been going very fast. And now there's natural getting older type of stuff. But I worry that it's been going a little faster than it should. And I'm worried about Alzheimer's myself, that I'm going to start losing my brain and some scary stuff.
Yeah.
But you've done well. You've lived a good life.
Yeah,
or you've played the game, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, those are the good things. We try to do that. I was thinking about that yesterday. It's like, I feel like I've played the game.
You have. You've made a dent. I would say that, you know, you've made an impression on somebody when you walk out of the room and shut the door. they still talk about you. Because 99% of the time, you walk out,
yeah.
walk outside, shut the door, they're on to whatever the right. other subject is. They're talking about it, and you're not even a...
My problem is I feel like what people say about me is probably just not kind, rather than anything else.
But you're good at it.
Oh, God. How's this? You grew up in Marin County.
Yeah.
And mountain bikes became a thing. Let's switch to bicycles. Now, when I came to Factory, you guys were doing Wednesday night rides, and bicycles were the star of the show at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned a few things about the olden days type of thing with Mert and his bikes, and you were in the county. What were you doing when mountain biking was starting to happen? Or when did you catch on with it?
I was doing motorcycle stuff.
Just all motorcycles then?
Yeah, let's see. I still have my intents. No, basically I was working on motorcycle stuff and riding motorcycles. Highway 1, Sunday morning ride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to do a few of those. But I think you did it when it was a little bit more legendary.
It was legendary.
It was crazy when I did it back in, like, the zeros.
Yeah.
And back in the old days, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting question I can't ask too many people. Why'd you hire me?
Can you
remember?
No, I'm gonna go by... What? Because as pissed off at you as I get sometimes, you're always smart. And you'd always bring things up that work or don't work. You're a good cross-check.
Mm-hmm.
And I could trust you. I couldn't imagine you cheating.
Mm-hmm.
You're a good cross-check.
Okay, because I couldn't have been a great mechanic at the time. I don't think I ever became a great motorcycle mechanic.
But you got pretty good.
I got good enough to change jets.
Yeah.
I wasn't the same thing. I've known real mechanics. I never was that. I could change parts. Later on, I became, in my mind, a better tuner of the non-power components of the bike, but... That's a little bit different.
No, you filled the slot.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's nice to know.
You were entirely adequate.
I was worried that I never really was, you know, just because I knew so much better mechanics, especially when I was even there, you know.
Joe Cioni's pretty good.
He was damn good.
Yeah.
He was damn good. I was lucky to work with him. I probably wouldn't have lasted if I was working with other folks that you had around a lot. But I could work with Joe, and we got it. We got each other. And that boy was... I didn't have a motorcycle at... Or I didn't have a running motorcycle at the time. That boy was into motors, and he was all about riding and wrenching. It's pretty inspiring on that level.
Yeah.
I always feel like you hired me because I knew about bicycles and you needed someone to fix your bicycle.
that's an option. That's an optional. That's a bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got anything more you want to say?
I appreciated you working for me.
Thank you.
And I could say you work with me.
Cool.
And it's good to see that you've progressed and don't hate me.
Oh, I didn't. I never hated you.
Yeah.
I got mad at you, but I never hated you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody has frustrations.
Yeah, I'm sure I got you a couple times.
Yeah, but I mean, that's just natural. You know, you were trying to do something. And I'm trying to do something too, but my thing is my life and where I was going and what I was doing.
Yeah.
And that meant leaving. I mean, how's this? I helped you out with a few other things later on. I did some CAD work for you and fixed your logo when you lost your vector version and something like that. After I'd learned some new skills.
Yeah. It was entirely enjoyable.
Cool. All right, Mark. Here,